Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listen to Tenjin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, I hope the Buddha's blessings have been with you over the last week. The Roman philosopher Epictetus, who was born in 55 CE, wrote, "Wealth consists not in having great possessions, but in having few wants." Now, apart from mirroring what the Buddha taught, that might be a fine theme for what we're talking about. For if you were with us last week, you will remember that we finished the program with some verses on the perils of making the accumulation of wealth the focus of your life. Of course, it's obvious that in everyday life, wealth can bring us some temporary comfort, but it has no capacity for long-term satisfaction. However, the verses we recited were particularly aimed at meditators who want to develop a very stable concentration. Shantideva, the author of The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Life, the text we are following in these programs, reminds us how the mind lusting after wealth is not the mind that will be able to develop that concentration. It'll be too much distracted thinking about bank balances. But before we read the verses again and talk about them a little, let's take a moment to set our motivation as usual. If you can, motivate that we are participating in the program to gain liberation from suffering not only for ourselves, but all others as well. To do that, we have to attain enlightenment. So may this program be a step on our path to enlightenment for the liberation of all. Thank you. Now, the Shantideva's verses we're talking about go like this. Some evil and lustful people wear themselves out by working all day, and when they return home in the evening, their exhausted bodies lie prostrate like corpses. Some have suffering of being disturbed with travel and having to go a long way from home. Although they long for their spouses, they do not see them for years at a time. And some who wish for benefit, due to confusion, even sell themselves for the sake of women and the like. But not attaining what they wish, they are aimlessly driven by the winds of others' actions. Some sell their own bodies, and without any power are employed by others. Even when their wives give birth, their children fall at the feet of trees and in lonely places. Some fools who are deceived by desire, wishing for a livelihood, think, "I shall earn my living as a soldier." Then, although afraid of losing their lives, they go to war. Others become slaves for the sake of profit. Some lustful people even cut their bodies. Others impale themselves on the points of sticks. Some stab themselves with daggers, and others burn themselves. Such things as these are quite apparent. Due to the torment involved in collecting it, protecting and finally losing it, I should realize wealth to be fraught with infinite problems. Those who are distracted by their attachment to it have no opportunity to gain freedom from the misery of conditioned existence. Some evil and lustful people wear themselves out by working all day, and when they return home in the evening, their exhausted bodies lie prostrate like corpses. Wow, Shantideva really doesn't have much respect for those who think hard work is the way to get ahead, does he? You see, when he talks about evil and lustful people, he's not necessarily talking about the mafia or the Don Juans of this world, but just people who spend their lives accumulating wealth. They're evil because of their attitude and the actions they needs must do to get wealth. As we all know, for instance, the aim of major corporations is to make money for their shareholders, and that often means that their ethics are ruled by contingency. So long as their profits go up every quarter, it matters little who is harmed. Over the last few years, we've seen many directors of finance companies in New Zealand face jail sentences because of the fraudulent way they allowed their companies to operate. Many New Zealanders who invested with these companies have been seriously harmed. It's strange how once people get on a wealth roll, they think they can do anything with impunity to make more money. They twist the truth, manipulate and outright lie in pursuit of another dollar or another $1 million. I visit Huffington Post on the internet from time to time, and my attention was caught by the story of a U.S. senator dedicated to helping the average everyman against the financial institutions dubbed too big to fail. Her name is Elizabeth Warren, and she's become very good at shaming both the big banks and their regulators, who seem to work hand in hand to further the profits of the banks at the expense of the small guy, especially after the recession the American economy has recently been through. Here's a report by Igor Volsky on the Think Progress website on Warren's confrontation with the bank regulators. Senator Elizabeth Warren embarrassed government regulators during a Senate Banking Committee hearing on Thursday morning as she demanded to know why they wouldn't reveal how frequently big banks illegally foreclosed on homeowners. In January, regulators abandoned a case-by-case review of foreclosure fraud conducted by some of the nation's largest banks in favor of a $9.3 billion settlement. Under the deal, most of the 4.4 million homeowners who were foreclosed on in 2009 or 2010 received less than $1,000 each. Fair housing advocates and Democratic lawmakers panned the agreement, claiming it short-circuited a more detailed review process known as independent foreclosure review and let banks off the hook for illegally foreclosing on millions of homeowners. Regulators had initially claimed banks broke the law or made errors in 6.5% of all the loans reviewed, though the number has since been revised upwards. During the hearing, Warren pressed officials from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve for answers about how frequently banks broke the law, only to discover that regulators didn't know the exact number before reaching their settlement and were now unwilling to publicize the error rate. You're saying that you did not have an estimate in mind of how many banks had broken the law and how many homeowners were the victims of illegal activities? Warren asked in disbelief. She pressed for public disclosure, but was told that the information about banks' illegal activities is proprietary and may not ever be released. Warren said, "So you've made the decision to protect the banks, but not a decision to tell the families who have been illegally foreclosed against." And Richard Aston from the Federal Reserve said, "We haven't made a decision about what information we would provide to individuals." And Warren replied, "So I just want to make sure I get this straight. Families get pennies in the dollar in the settlement for having been the victims of illegal activities or mistakes in the bank's activities. You now know individual cases where the banks violated the law, and you're not going to tell the homeowners, or at least it's not clear if you're going to do that." You can see how the lust for money and more money leads not only to corruption in organizations, but also in those who are supposed to be regulating those organizations. And that includes governments. This is the evil that Shantideva talks about. And although our example focuses on America's big banks, it applies equally well to individuals. Just visit India with a white face, and prices for you go up exponentially. Shantideva implies that all this actually achieves is exhaustion at the end of the working day, and in coming lives, a karmic payback of enormous suffering. Carrying on with his theme of the foolishness of thinking only of this life's wealth, he talks about how people travel long distances from home in the line of their work, sometimes staying away for months or years at a time. YouTube is full of videos of soldiers returning home after long stints in Afghanistan or Iraq to surprise their loved ones. Some of the soldiers will never return. And this all just validates Shantideva's point that for the sake of gathering enough wealth for their families, men and women will even endanger their lives. In her commentary on this work, Pema Chodron also points out that in 8th century India, it was not uncommon for lower caste men in certain tribes to borrow money to get married. Then they become indentured to the lender, she writes. To gather enough wealth to attract a bride, whole generations of a family could become indebted. The son inherits the debt of the father, and so on, and in this way they become slaves. By the time the poor man gets his bride, he might be too old to satisfy his lust. And this still happens today. I've heard of Indian peasants who have inherited a piece of land, but also the debt that goes with it. The produce from the land is not enough to pay off the debt, and so the debt just gets larger and larger. Some farmers have committed suicide because of this, especially when the monsoon failed or delivered such floods that the crops are lost. While I was in India, I also heard of whole villages that put themselves up for sale in desperation. But even if we are not doing so badly, we're not free from discomfort. As Pema Chodron says, we develop a dream of what will bring us comfort and pleasure, but in trying to achieve it, we miss the point that our efforts are often painful and absurd. We buy a beautiful silk shirt and accidentally splatter it with salad dressing, she writes. We save up money and buy our dream car, but when it's parked on the street, we worry ourselves sick that someone might scratch it. Of course, having no money is also extremely painful. But unfortunately, it's rare for any of us to be content with just enough to meet our basic needs. And so, she says, the goal of happiness eludes us despite all our worries and toil. His Holiness the Dalai Lama in his commentary agrees, saying that we go to great lengths to obtain wealth, even to the extent of being prepared to lose our lives. But once we have it, he says, we are forever afraid of losing it. Pointing out the ridiculousness of making the attainment of wealth a central pillar of our lives, he writes, because of wealth, brothers and sisters are set at odds, couples break up. When we don't have wealth, we suffer, and when we do have it, we also suffer. But possibly the main disadvantage of the lust for wealth is listed by Shantideva in the last line of the final verse. Those who are distracted by their attachment to wealth have no opportunity to gain freedom from the misery of conditioned existence. When our minds are consumed by getting money and things, there's no space to even think of finding a final liberation from the variety of our sufferings. Always thinking that the next $1 million or Chippendale coffee table will make us happy, we don't examine what happiness really is or where it is to be found, so we waste this life in meaningless collections. When death finally arrives, what do we have to show for all our efforts? We cannot take 1 cent of our fortune with us, no matter how many millions are in the bank, nor 1 small piece of antique furniture, even if it is from the most revered furniture maker on the planet. Everything must be left behind for others to squabble over while we start a new journey with the same grasping mind we cultivated so diligently during our life. And with that kind of mind, do you think we will land up in a joyful or a miserable situation in our coming life? I think the prognosis will not be good. Shantideva goes on to say, in the same way as animals drawing carriages are only able to eat a few mouthfuls of grass, likewise desirous people have many disadvantages such as these and little profit. Hour after hour, day after day, animals are made to work, drawing carts or ploughs. Now, maybe this is not now so evident in first world countries like New Zealand, but it's very common in India and South Africa, countries I have some experience with. And what is the animal's reward? A few handfuls of grass at the end of the day. Shantideva likens this to people who spend every waking moment scheming how to get more money. At the end of their day, the satisfaction is no more than that of the animal who chews on his cud at nightfall, even though they may make a vast fortune. Shantideva continues, and since even animals can obtain this little profit, those who are pained by their previous actions waste these leisures and endowments so difficult to find for the sake of something trivial that is not so scarce? Well, it's not too difficult for animals to get a few mouthfuls of food. And for people, similarly, it's not too difficult, if you put your mind to it, to accumulate wealth. However, that wealth can only give us a limited amount of temporary comfort. So in terms of enlightenment, it is truly trivial, as Shantideva says. And focusing our mind on that, we waste the rare and golden opportunity to use this life for the greater goal of enlightenment. When Shantideva talks of leisures and endowments so difficult to find, he's referring to the precious human rebirth that has 18 qualities divided into 8 leisures and 10 endowments. Now, we've covered these in a previous program, but basically, all human lives are not precious human rebirths. If our life has these 18 qualities, the conditions for us to practice the Dharma are good. However, if any of these qualities are missing, it becomes difficult to follow the Buddha's teachings and attain enlightenment. Very briefly, the 8 leisures are that we are not born in the hell, hungry ghost, animal, or long-lived god realms. That's 4. Then the other 4 are that we have been born in an age when the Buddha has appeared and when there are teachings. We are also free of wrong views and of lacking faculties. Then the 10 endowments are that we are human and born in a country where the teachings have taken root, and also we have faith in the teachings. We have all our faculties and have committed none of the 5 heinous crimes that at death result in an immediate rebirth in hell. The Buddha has appeared in our age and he has taught. Well, some Buddhas appear but don't teach. The teachings are still with us and are followed. And finally, we are fortunate enough to have benefactors who will help us in our Dharma practice, like looking after us when we are on retreat. Now, it's difficult to get all these 18 conditions in one life, so now that we have them, we should try to make as good use of this life as we can. And that doesn't mean gathering wealth. Often people will say, "Oh, I first have to make money, look after my family, and put my children through their education. Then later, I will practice the Dharma." Now, this is like saying, "I will never practice the Dharma. I'm too intent on creating wealth and a good life for myself." In the end, we only throw away a very precious and rare opportunity for the sake of something that is completely ephemeral and doesn't make us happy. As Pema Chodron points out, we'll go through great discomfort to get a raise or an extra week of vacation. To get on the boss's good sides, we'll work overtime without pay or whatever it takes. Now, isn't this similar to the ox that pulls the cart, sweating and miserable, only to be rewarded by a mouthful of hay? This is Shantideva's analogy for the pain we cause ourselves, even for the smallest pleasures. Meanwhile, we're wasting the precious opportunity of this fleeting human life. And then Shantideva goes on, "The objects of desire will certainly perish, and then I shall fall into hellish states. But Buddhahood itself is attained with just 1/1,000,000th of the difficulty. Involved in continually exhausting myself for the sake of what is not very great. Involved in continually exhausting myself for the sake of what is not very great. Hence the desirous experience greater misery than those following the awakening way of life. But from them there is no awakening." Pema Chodron says that the first of these verses refers to the pain of samsaric existence. As one Buddhist verse says, she writes, "Friends, wealth, homes, and other transitory comforts are like a banquet before the executioner leads us to our death. We may get everything we want, but the pleasure is fleeting. What's more, if we harm anyone in the process, the end result will be pain. Even if we harm no one, we still strengthen our craving habit, which is never in our best interest." And she points out in regard to the second verse that with a fraction of the time and effort we spend on our worldly existence, we could make enormous progress on the path to enlightenment. She writes, "I remember hearing one teacher say, 'If I gave you all a pack of cards and a case of beer, you could stay up, enthusiastic, alert, and energetic for days on end. But ask you to sit for a couple of hours in the evening, and you all fall sound asleep.'" At the point of these two verses, His Holiness the Dalai Lama gives a quite long but very touching exposition in his book, A Flash of Lightning in the Dark of Night, which is a commentary on this text. His Holiness goes like this. We should examine the things that excite our distracted thoughts. Gradually these thoughts will become less strong and our minds will become more calm. Then we'll be able to meditate one-pointedly on bodhicitta. The main meditation on bodhicitta consists of considering oneself and others to be equal and then exchanging oneself with others. As Shantideva says about bodhicitta in chapter 1, verse 7, all the Buddhas who have contemplated for many eons have seen it to be beneficial, for by it the limitless masses of beings will quickly attain the supreme state of bliss. His Holiness goes on, the masters of the Kadampa tradition left detailed teachings on different ways of practicing bodhicitta. By generating bodhicitta through such practices, we can purify all our obscurations and accumulate positive actions. It is said that we have to accumulate merit over three uncountable kalpas, but these terms are relative. With the attitude of bodhicitta, such enormous amounts of merit are quickly and easily achieved. All the learned and accomplished masters, from Buddha through Nagarjuna and his disciples, down to our own present teachers, took the practice of considering others more important than themselves as the foundation of their practice. Through this, they were able to benefit themselves and others on a vast scale. Anyone who has good thoughts, who does a lot to help others, and who leaves behind good memories, is respected by people all over the world, regardless of whether they are religious or not. On the other hand, the ignorance, arrogance, and obstinacy of certain individuals, whether their intentions were good or evil, have been the root of all the tragedies of history. The mere names of these ruthless tyrants inspire fear and loathing. So the extent to which people will like us naturally depends on how much or how little we think of others' good. Speaking of my own experience, I sometimes wonder why a lot of people like me, says His Holiness. When I think about it, I cannot find in myself any specially good quality except for one small thing. That is the positive mind, which I try to explain to others and which I do my best to develop myself. Of course, there are moments when I do get angry, but in the depth of my heart, I do not hold a grudge against anyone. I cannot pretend that I'm really able to practice bodhicitta, but it does give me tremendous inspiration. Deep inside me, I realize how valuable and beneficial it is, and that is all. And I try as much as possible to consider others to be more important than myself. I think that's why people take note of me and like me, because of my good heart. And when people say I've worked a lot for peace, I feel embarrassed. I feel like laughing. I don't think I've done very much for world peace. It's just that my practice is the peaceful path of kindness, love, compassion, and not harming others. This has become part of me. It's not something for which I've especially volunteered. I am simply a follower of the Buddha, and the Buddha taught that patience is the supreme means for transcending suffering. He said, if a monk harms another, he's not a monk. I'm a Buddhist monk, so I try to practice accordingly. When people think this practice is something unique and special and call me a leader of the world peace, I feel almost ashamed. A good heart is the source of all happiness and joy, and we can all be good-hearted if we make an effort. But better still is to have bodhicitta, which is a good heart imbued with wisdom. It is the strong desire to attain enlightenment in order to deliver all beings from suffering and bring them to Buddhahood. This thought of helping others is rooted in compassion, which grows from a feeling of gratitude and love for beings who are afflicted by suffering. And then His Holiness goes on to describe two ways of developing gratitude and love for others. One is to reflect that in previous lives, all beings have been our mothers or very close to us, and so benefited us hugely. Then we will feel gratitude and wish to relieve their suffering. The other method is to realize that all suffer just as we do, to see that we are all equal, and consider the disadvantages of egoism and the advantages of altruism. We can use either method, but we must first understand what we call suffering. His Holiness writes, "It is easy enough for us to feel compassion for people who are starving, in pain, or in great distress, and for animals who are maltreated. But when we think of human and celestial beings who are very happy, we tend to feel envious. This is because we have not really understood what suffering is, and that all beings suffer. Apart from the more obvious torments of the suffering of suffering, and that by that he means what we normally regard as discomfort or suffering, and the suffering of change, there is all-pervading suffering. Because of the latter, as long as we are in samsara, we can never have lasting happiness. Now, once we've reflected on and understood this for ourselves, we can apply this understanding to others. Then we start to feel compassion and think, I must free all these beings from suffering. However, to actually do so, we have to change our approach to this life and to our future lives. First, we must reflect on impermanence, on the certainty of our own death, and on the fact that we can never know how soon we might die. After death, we will not simply vanish. The positive and negative actions we have done will determine how we are reborn. Our negative actions might cause us to be reborn in the lower realms, for example, as animals, exploited, maltreated, and butchered by humans, or devoured by other animals. So, to free ourselves from the ocean of suffering, we should begin to study and practice the path of liberation. We might hope to see some result after a few years, but speaking realistically, we should plan on probably having to continue our practice over many lives to come. In each of these lives, we're going to need a proper support for practice, namely a human body, without which it will be impossible to make progress. The first stage of the path, therefore, is to ensure a good human rebirth. So although our final aim is to achieve enlightenment for all beings, we have to begin the path by following the discipline of avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions and practicing the 10 virtuous actions. To summarize, we start by getting rid of our attachment to non-spiritual goals, first in this life, then in future lives. Having seen the suffering inherent in samsara, we resolve to free ourselves, and as we extend this attitude to other beings, we develop compassion and generate bodhicitta. We have to go through these stages of training the mind in the right order, like going up some stairs, or like building the foundation before we build a wall. If we follow the path gradually in this way, the result we will have will be stable. But if we simply say, for the sake of all beings, however strong our wish to help beings might be at that moment, it will not be stable unless it is well founded on the correct practice of the earlier stages. In the beginning, we should have a clear overall view of the path so that we know what we're aiming at in our practice and recognize the level we've reached. Then, as we practice regularly, we may experience profound changes in our minds. But these experiences only occur when we are concentrating in sessions of meditation. Later, after meditating for a long time, we find that these experiences occur spontaneously when we encounter particular circumstances, without our needing to concentrate in meditation. And with that to inspire you, we must part, for our time together is up today. Please dedicate any positive energy we've accumulated to bodhicitta, gaining enlightenment to benefit all beings everywhere. Thanks for joining us today, and please tune in again next week. Until then, goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.